And welcome back to In the Moment. The final presidential debate between President Donald Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden, that's tomorrow night. It could be very different from the first debate if the rules are truly in effect. And Governor Kristi Noem has been a road warrior campaigning for both President Trump and raising money for her next election. Is she neglecting South Dakota's COVID crisis? Thankfully, it's that time of week when we welcome the Dakota Political Junkies to In the Moment. Kevin Killer is a former South Dakota lawmaker and a senior fellow with PRISM. Kevin, it's good to have you back. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Laurie. Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
And John Hunter is publisher of the Madison Daily Leader. John, great to have you back, too.
Hi, Laurie. I'm glad to be here.
Let's start with a debate. Why not, right? It's coming up, and there has been quite a journey to get to this part. Usually presidential debates are interesting, but perhaps not this unpredictable. Tomorrow night, new rules in place. John Hunter, let's start with you and tell us a little bit. I guess they're not really new rules, but a new tool in the toolbox to sort of keep the interruptions from happening. Tell us what we know.
Well, like most things in the last 4 years, we're kind of, you know, revisiting old rules and so forth. Remember, this commission that sets up these presidential debates is intended to be, I guess you'd call it non-biased, and so it's not set up by it's not a federal government thing. It's not set up by the administration. It's intended to somehow do this, and we've had presidential debates for about 60 years in this kind of live TV format. So, yes, they are kind of revisiting. I think most people thought the first debate was a bit unwieldy and not as useful, so the debate crew decided, let's try to tweak this a little bit more. Maybe, as you indicated, Laurie, maybe not new rules, but maybe let's clarify and tighten down these rules about interrupting in particular. So there still will be some interrupting taking place. They will have the ability to turn off mics during certain segments, I believe, during kind of statements rather than discussion points. But it will, mics will be open and not cut off during other parts, too. So right. I would expect not tremendous changes. I think the moderator will have a bigger challenge. I mean, the biggest challenge in the first one was it was unexpected. Now it's probably expected, so maybe it'll be a little easier.
Mm-hmm. I love that. A bit unwieldy and not as useful. That's so reasonable, John. I can't tell you how many times I've struggled to come up with a word to describe the first debate.
And unwieldy is it.
I wrote that down, a bit unwieldy and not as useful. I'm going to pull that out next time we're trying it. Kevin Killer, I want to ask you about, I laugh and I kind of make light of it, but really it's nothing to laugh about because this is America's opportunity to understand the issues more deeply, to help decide if, there are still some undecided voters or people who are thinking about not voting who might be encouraged to show up and vote for issues that are important. This is a really important time in American life right now with all that's going on. We need a serious debate. Talk a little bit, Kevin, if you will, about, the potential for having a real rigorous but yet respectful debate and what it means to everyone who's watching.
Sure. And I appreciate, the perspective because, calling it unwielding and unwieldy is certainly the case because, I think people expect this certain decorum from their elected officials, and I don't think we've seen any of that in the last 4 years, and it's been changing, and sometimes for the better, sometimes for the worse, and I think one of the things that, I look at debates and I come into them, and being in South Dakota, I think one of the things that people have been acknowledging on both sides of the aisle and at all levels is the presence of Native issues, but when you kind of elevate that to national level, you very rarely hear that. You very rarely hear the mention of Native Americans, anything to that degree. And I just think about a lot of the undecided voters in some of these states like Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota, where there's a significant population of Native people. It's how does that speak to the turnout? Mm-hmm. And so then putting that on a bigger scale, is that, you know, this is why it's so important to kind of pay attention to what people are saying and what they're talking about and not trying to score political points on each other. And I think that's, you know, partly the narratives that go in before and the pre-expectations, and just really helping the listeners and viewers understand that, you know, get that, you know, try to block that out of your mind and just sit there and listen. And I think that's where, you know, an undecided voter will sit there and say that, well, this is the same thing that I've heard for the past 4 years. Nothing's going to change, you know, and then, you know, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. So I think that's one thing, you know, like to kind of take into the debate is just, you know, come into it, you know, like, you know, what your issue is, whatever that may be. And if the candidates address it, then hopefully they do. If not, then, you know, understand that at least, you know, you as a citizen was prepared to hear that from our elected officials.
Yeah. I'm wondering, too, and Kevin, I'll start with you and then ask John this question, but the idea of if something becomes circus-like or unwatchable, or as John said, not useful. We talk so often about encouraging voter turnout, you know, whichever candidate you support, we encourage you to, you know, to make a plan and go vote. But this whole notion of people throwing up their arms in disgust and saying this is unwatchable, it's not useful. It can be. I'm not saying it's a kind of voter suppression, but I am asking, Kevin, is it unhelpful to the sense that it can make people tune out of democracy and therefore really disenfranchise themselves if something is so unwieldy and hopeless that people turn completely away from the political process?
Yeah, and I think, you know, that is, again, it is a narrative that's set up for people and, you know, to think that way. And I think that's one of the good things about being in South Dakota is that, you know, we kind of relate to our local politicians a little bit more, a little bit closer. Mm-hmm. Like we know our neighbors, we know our people, we know who's running for office, and we usually know them on a first name basis. You know, and I think just a couple of days ago, I saw Dusty Johnson somewhere, and I just called him Dusty. You know, and that's really unusual. You know, for like any other like these bigger states where they don't know their elected officials, they don't know people who's representing them. And so it's easy to kind of play into that, you know, saying that government doesn't work for you because you don't know your people. And I think that's something that's really unique to kind of take away from this is that, you know, at the end of the day, you know, we know who our elected officials are. We know who our local representatives are in most cases. We know who our mayors are. You know, we know who our county commissioners are. And just really, you know, bringing it back to that home of you know, this is, you know, in South Dakota, usually all politics are local. So,
yeah. John, anything you want to add to that about just the participation in the process? And when we don't have people showing up to vote, how many people feel like, you know, they're not part of this democracy at all? That can create real problems down the road for, am I thinking too broadly, John? Bring me back
to reality
if I'm going over the edge here.
No, I'm with you. You're firmly grounded in reality.
Oh, good.
But I will go a little bit opposite in this. In this mm-hmm. particular presidential election, I think is, if you see that the debate is unwatchable or you don't like this kind of thing, it often turns to apathy. But this particular one seems to have gotten some people fired up. I mean, I think we'll see record participation in this. I mean, they're setting up, there's so many get out the vote kinds of activities and so forth. I do think there is probably some segments of the population that, especially I think for people in, and I don't know what the term is, but in places where it's become difficult to vote, and that might be state, you know, if they don't have polling places nearby or if they have restrictive hours or those sorts of things. But I do think this election will see really strong turnout. And now we have started an era, at least a little bit, of distrust where, you know, many people thought parts of government were corrupt. And I think the rhetoric over the last some period of time has kind of indicated that everybody's corrupt. And I don't think it's fair. But I do think you will see the kind of things that are going on in this debate and this campaign will actually spur turnout. I think it'll be very strong.
And that can make a huge issue for down ballot, for the ballot questions, for example, John. If you have
That's a great point.
If you have a huge turnout for, you know, the competition or the contest between President Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden, marijuana is right there on the other side of that ballot. And whoever shows up with that voter turnout is also going to decide some pretty significant legislative issues. Yeah.
And yeah. I think to a lesser degree, maybe a state legislative candidate.
Right.
They may be part of that too, but you know, we don't really kind of have top of the ballot checking anymore, you know, like there used to be, where you just say, just one check will give me all the Republicans or all the Democrats. So I don't think that's quite the coattails thing that it used to be, where you'd vote for a presidential candidate and all the other people of that party would get your vote. I think people are a little more discerning than that. But yeah, I think it's possible, and I feel good about strong turnout, regardless of how people vote, whether it's the way I agree with them or disagree.
Right.
I'm glad to see people participating.
Yeah, it's nice to stand after the election and the votes are counted and know that that's really what people wanted, instead of, you know, an incredibly low voter turnout. And then
we had one of those, you know, Lori, in Madison a couple of years ago, where we had insanely low turnout for an issue, and it turned local candidate thing. And I mean, we're talking like less than 10% turnout on this thing. And I think it helped determine which candidate won. I think if you'd gotten 50% or 70 or whatever, if it was tied to a presidential election, it's possible the outcome would have been different. But so yeah, I do think participation can change the results of these.
Yeah. You know,
I'm glad for that.
Yeah. Kevin mentioned Congressman Dusty Johnson, who I think a lot of people call Dusty, and he's popular. We learned in hour one of this program about a new South Dakota state poll that said of all the elected officials, he has the highest, you know, affection meter or warmth meter or approval rating. I can't remember exactly how the question is phrased. I apologize for that. And looking at Donald Trump, President Trump taking a little bit of a dip in his popularity, which does not mean people aren't going to vote for him. That wasn't the question. It just was about your impression of him. And I want to pivot a little bit to talk about Governor Noem. As we, one of the questions this poll from South Dakota State University political scientist was asking was, you know, is Governor Noem's, does she have the same priorities that you have? Does she care about people like me? That sort of thing. Is she spending too much time raising money on the campaign trail? So let's talk a little bit about that, about Governor Noem and campaigning and what we're seeing about her traveling in the days heading up into this election. Kevin, do you want to start there? What are we learning about her activities, and what is some of the response to those activities?
Sure. I think one of the things that you know, in a crisis, you know, and I think it's fair to call it a crisis right now. You know, because I just look at the availability of hospital beds in the state, and what's being reported in the media, and what's being reported, and what's being said by, you know, different community members in Pine Ridge, and just how we're, you know, even talking with a district chairman who represents one of our local communities, and he mentioned that they're rerouting some patients, you know, out of the state. And I think even getting people to understand that is that, you know, this is becoming a serious issue in South Dakota. And, you know, we need communication at all levels, you know, and I think it's important that we have that communication, because, you know, we need to kind of have faith that our systems, you know, as fragile as they are. And I think over the whole time I've been a guest and all this kind of stuff, that we've been talking about COVID almost every time I've been on, you know, and so it's not going away. And just really understanding that, you know, this is something that needs to be addressed and something that needs to be kind of taken serious in this state, because, you know, our healthcare systems are really vulnerable to influx of people, you know. And I think I mentioned that during Sturges, and I mentioned that before. And just really repeating that message is that, you know, we need to make sure that we have communications at all kind of different levels. And I think you've seen different state governors do that. You know, I'm thinking of New York, for example, and granted, we're not as big as New York, we're like New York, but you know, the governor made it a point to get on the radio every day and TV and be visible and say that this is what's going on, this is what's happening. And I think initially they did start that and they did do that, but, you know, I mean, that might be something that they need to consider again. So.
Yeah. Forum News Service, South Dakota News Director Jeremy Fugelberg put together an article with her schedule and where she's been: Pennsylvania, Iowa, Ohio, Michigan, Minnesota twice, Texas twice, Florida twice, New Hampshire, Wisconsin. Raised $850,000 between May and October for her, you know, for her campaign coffers. And John Hunter, on one hand, that shows her popularity, that she's being asked and invited to these places, that you can raise $850,000 from supporters is an indication of the kind of support she's receiving. But that is also, as Kevin said, bringing up some questions at home, saying, you know, when she says, "I trusted my people," and here at home, we're entering these dark days of the pandemic and looking at exponential growth and some of the things we've been talking about with public health officials about what happens in the days ahead and what are these numbers telling us about where we're at right now. There's a lot at stake politically for the governor right now. The stakes seem higher than ever for her, just from a political standpoint. What are your thoughts on that, John?
Lorraine, I'm going to back up just a little bit, and that is in the last half century, maybe more, in South Dakota, we tend to elect our officials at a fairly young age. Almost all the senators, representatives, and governors were first elected in their 30s. We've had very few who were elected older. And part of that, I think, is because they're kind of a child of South Dakota, someone who was from here, who we know, we saw in their youth, and we want that youthful enthusiasm. The table always turns when people are considered outsiders, when they have gone to Washington and become some part of that Washington establishment, no longer one of us. And I can name a whole bunch of those. Remember, if you remember the limousine Larry, which I think Larry Pressler did, and then, you know, the Tom Daschle quote, "I'm a D.C. resident," and each of these things, eventually, when they become part of that, and, you know, it's sometimes reality. So the question is I think Christie is very much thought of as one of us, you know, grew up a rancher, you know, went to Castlewood High School and served in the state legislature, very much one of us. So the question is, will the perception of her change from a South Dakota person to a national person? I don't think her time in Congress did that. She was there, I think, a short enough period of time that she didn't seem as though she was part of that crowd and not our crowd. And she has indicated she doesn't necessarily want to go back. But I think if the perception turns that she is now one of the D.C. folks and not one of South Dakotans, I think it could have consequences. But I do think it's probably the only thing. I don't think it's particularly campaigning for a particular candidate or even the views that she's expressing.
Yeah. And, of course, the argument before we close, we should say in fairness that this campaign, I have not heard this from their mouths, but they would say that her campaigning for this president, it's an important election, and she truly believes that this president is what is best for South Dakota, and she's on that campaign trail,
right?
Not for us, but for the state. And she would, I'm quite sure, list the reasons why she thinks that is, and it's a tight election. It's a tight race between these two candidates. So we're going to talk more about this politics in the future, but for now, John Hunter, thanks so much for being here with us.
Thanks, Lori.
Kevin Keller, thank you as well.
Thank you, Lori.